The second part of the interview with Harold Saunders took place in Washington, D.C. on February 24, 1987.
Okay. Now, one thing you mentioned in our last interview was that you noted that the U.S. played a direct role in the Shah's decisions on weapons purchases and military spending generally. Now, I gather this was a source of irritation to the Shah at some points. Do you recall if he tried to find ways to reduce U.S. influence on these decisions during the Johnson administration, 1968, early 1969?
Well, I can't cite a specific instance, but I'm sure that every time he came to see the president, there was an effort to circumvent that process and go straight to the president, get the president's approval. Yeah. In preparations for the Shah's visit, I think we mentioned last time, there were always predictable wish lists that were part of the Shah's equipment when he came on these visits, and our job was to try to prepare the president for these, because we knew the Shah would try to hit him directly on them, and of course the bureaucracy had an interest in letting the president know what position had been taken and what the reasons for it were.
Okay. Now, during the 60s, the Johnson administration, maybe even late in the Kennedy administration, who were some of the influential people in executive agencies who were concerned with Iran issues generally that you might have worked with at some level?
We mentioned a number last time. Chris was my boss, Bob Comer, Ken Hansen, and RMD. During that early period when the review of the military assistance program was going on, I think Bill Bundy was the Deputy Assistant Secretary in Defense, ISA, who was part of that. Now, he did not deal with Iran as Iran, but he would have been part of that overall group. I think Walt Rostow, in both the White House and later the State Department capacities, retained an interest in that. I'm not sure who the policy planning staff person was during that period. It may have been Bill Polk, who also did a lot of things in Near Eastern affairs, that is, the Arab Israel.
In the State Department.
In the State Department. Policy planning. Yeah. And, of course, the assistant secretary, Bill Talbot, the ambassador.
Do you know who at the Pentagon or CIA may have had some role in these things? Besides Bundy. At a lower level, the Pentagon.
I don't remember.
Any CIA people or AID people that might be like that?
Yeah, names.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. Do you recall?
There's one other person, Armin Meyer, who was not, I think, involved in Iranian affairs at this moment, but because of his later position, he was in the Bureau at this time. And a lot of Iran things may have rubbed off. And Stuart Rockwell, who was a retired fire and service part service officer, who was, I think, an office director or a deputy assistant secretary at that time.
I think he was a DCM at one point.
But later on he served as DCM, but I think he was in the department at this point. But the time is good.
Do you get a sense of how influential the ambassadors were in making policy recommendations, or did they have a lot of clout in decisions like on arms sales and so forth? Or?
There are really two kinds of ambassadors as viewed in the Kennedy and early, during the Bundy period in the NSC staff. One was a kind of ambassador like John Badeau in Cairo, who was picked by the Kennedy administration for his special sensitivity to his environment, and he was listened to fairly substantially. But I think there was another kind, and I think maybe Ambassador Holmes may have fallen in this category, that very senior career officers not picked by the Kennedy administration from outside, per se. And I think there that the general attitude was that, of course, these people were listened to, but I think also the attitude in the White House was more in terms how to get those career ambassadors to see things through the president's eyes. So those ambassadors were looked at more as objects than as sources of knowledge. Objects, people whose minds need to be changed, need to be brought into the presidential perspective. This is not to downgrade their knowledge or analysis, but simply to characterize attitudes.
Would Myers fit into that category or the other category? He's into the Rostov group, I guess.
I don't think he would fit into the second category.
Now, during the 60s, did you have any discussions with Iranian officials in Washington? Did you ever meet with Iranian embassy officials from time to time? Or
No, during that early period, I was a junior member of the staff. Did not do that.
Okay. Now, I've read that in the mid-60s, around 65, the U.S. tried to discourage the Shah from building up Iran's naval presence in the Persian Gulf. Do you recall any NSC discussion of that, or any discussion on that issue at all? Even if the fact it's true, I read it in a secondary source. I have no further evidence on it.
I think, I don't remember explicitly, but I think it would have come up in the context that the basic thrust of military assistance to Iran was to rationalize the Iran's armed forces, and that primarily was thought of in terms of ground forces and air force, and that the idea of building a navy was, in resource terms, thought to go beyond any reasonable allocation of resources to the military and to be lower priorities. I think the extent that the subject was discussed, it would be in terms of providing Iran with a minimal focal capability, but not a blue water navy, which the Shah ultimately, of course, aspired to.
Yes. Around the same time, I guess mid 60s, I read there was debate between Washington and Tehran, and within Washington as well, over the Shah's request to buy F-4 fighter jets. And I read that he charged the U.S. price for F-4s is too high. And apparently he threatened to go to Moscow to buy Soviet MiGs, which he claimed were cheaper in price. Do you recall this issue or how it was handled?
I don't remember it explicitly.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in 57, you became a member of the NSC senior staff, apparently. Now, what responsibilities did that bring to you? What did that mean in terms of what you your activities in the council?
I was doing essentially the same thing, except that I was the senior person, but working under somebody. Yeah. I was doing the senior job, but essentially I was working in the same area in the same kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Were there any important changes in the way the NSC worked in the years since you first joined the staff, say by late in the Johnson administration?
The main changes were those that gradually evolved as Lyndon Johnson became more comfortable in the role of the president and particularly came to understand how he wanted to use the NSC system. There were fundamental changes. He felt that the Kennedy staff was too ad hoc, too freewheeling. He felt that he would be more comfortable if there was more of a systematized approach, a system that one could describe and understand and see the wheels visibly turning. So. At that point, I think the idea of regional groups under the assistant secretaries was regularized. Not that they hadn't taken place before, but there was a three-tiered system set up, which included the regional groups at the assistant secretary level, and then Johnson did something at the next level up in terms of a group, I think it was called the Senior Interdepartmental Group, which was to be chaired by the Deputy Secretary of State, George Ball and the Katzenbach. And this was to be the cabinet, sub-cabinet level at which recommendations for the president were thrashed out to include not only all of the normal options that a professional team would come up with at the assistant secretary level, one step down, but also to factor in the politics of the options. And that group was to present one recommendation to the president. Then the next level up, the third level, the NSC level itself, was the president sitting with his cabinet members, either more formally in the NSC in the cabinet room of the White House, or less formally and more frequently in the Tuesday lunch group. But there was a desire by Johnson to have some semblance of a recognized machinery that produced options for him. What was different between his way of doing things and the later Nixon way, and I guess the previous Kennedy way, was that review function, the review of the options, was placed in the State Department, whereas Nixon pulled it back to the White House under Kissinger with the feeling that any group of that kind sitting in any department would end up giving a lot of energy to working at one option. The president would be deprived of real choices. Nixon felt that by bringing the review function back to the White House under his NSC advisor, he would be assured of having a range of options fully staffed out by their respective advocates.
Now, these regional groups you mentioned earlier, they're one of the assistant secretaries, were they interagency groups?
Yes. Well,
okay.
The NSC system was set up to coordinate.
I was asking you about the regional groups that were chaired by the assistant secretaries.
The purpose of the NSC system was to coordinate all those in the government dealing with a particular problem, and the assistant secretary level group was really the mechanism for bringing together all those in the bureaucracy at the senior professional level who were dealing with a particular problem. So there would be people sitting there from defense, CIA, AID, different parts of state, Treasury if necessary, and the NSC staff as well, at the senior working level. And then the senior interdepartmental group was the same interdepartmental composition, but elevated to the cabinet, sub-cabinet level.
Now, you as an NSC officer, you were involved in some of those groups? Or you sat in?
I certainly sat in on the assistant secretary level group. Might have sat in on the NSC group.
Was it in the Eastern Affairs group, or was it broken down regionally?
When I say the NSC itself, I would have sat in on NSC meetings itself. Mm-hmm. Normally, the person who sat on the senior departmental group would have been the National Security Advisor, and not I. Mm-hmm. Although, in the period after Johnson, when the NSC advisor chaired that review group, then I, as an NSC staff member, would have attended that group as well. So I would have sat at all levels.
Now, around the mid to the late 60s, the Shah was pressing the consortium of petroleum companies that invested in Iran. He was trying to press them to expand production and increase revenues for his government. The companies tried to oppose those pressures generally because they feared a glut in world markets, so falling oil prices and so forth. Did these issues come to the NSC staff's attention?
They would have been aware of them, but by and large, there were not government decisions that were required there, because they were between the government of Iran and private American companies.
They didn't make any complaints to the White House, that you recall the companies, or made any efforts to...
Sure, there would be informal contacts and so on, but period of time when there was reluctance on both sides, private sector and government, to get involved in something that was regarded as essentially a non-governmental affair. I mean, we think the U.S. government did not want to get itself in the middle of a negotiation between the government of an oil-producing country and these companies, for us to become an arbiter in that, that it then is, complicated in our, given our antitrust laws and a variety of other legislation that.
Now, about this time, 1957, the British announced their decision to begin phasing out their military presence at Persian Gulf. Do you recall if they gave the administration much forewarning about their decision?
I can't remember when we were notified, but obviously we had forewarning because they weren't actually going to withdraw until several years later, but the beginning of 1970, I guess. As I recall, though, the bulk of the U.S. government staff work that was done, I would have thought was done in the first year of the Nixon administration rather than earlier, although it's possible that some of that kept going earlier.
Yes, I remember reading somewhere that around January 68, Eugene Rostow, the Undersecretary of State about that time, proposed that a broad security grouping, including Turkey, Pakistan, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, be set up to fill in the gap left by the British as the British withdrew. Do you remember if that was discussed as a proposal that would be
developed? There must have been staff work going on at this time, but as I said, I can't remember the really big systematic effort in the first year of the next administration.
Okay. Now, another major event, 67, was the 6 days Arab-Israeli conflict. Did that have any impact in particular on policy towards Iran that comes to mind?
Not really. The one thing that was involved here, of course, was the fact that Israel had maintained a relationship with Iran, and Iran was a source of oil for Israel. And, factor to be thought about, but certainly, I mean, Iran's importance to the United States generally was elevated by a slight amount simply because of the relationship with Israel. That's one add-on to Iran, our overall interest in Iran.
Think about the arms sales issues. That, I don't know if you remember this, but when the White House made decisions on military credits to Iran during the course of the 1960s, was there much consultation with Congress about the credits and the arrangements?
There certainly was not the requirement then that exists now to consult at each step of the way, but there was a great deal of attention to the Congress in the context of the annual presentation of those portions of the budget that dealt with military assistance and economic assistance. So I think if you went back in those days, AID would do a presentation book for the Congress on our aid posture toward Iran, for instance, and there was a requirement that we look not just at the economic development aspects of it, but other programs. It was to be a coherent overall assistance approach to the country, military and economic alike. So in that context, each year, there would have been a presentation of a rationale which justified the allocation of resources between economic and military. In that sense, there was certainly there were discussions with Congress, and those presentations were, I think, probed by congressional staff. But whether that was consultation. I think it depends on what one means by consultation, but certainly not in the yay or nay way in which we close arms sales today.
Yeah, I've got the sense when you saw the secondary accounts that there was sort of an effort to evade too much congressional scrutiny on some of these decisions. Did you get a sense that was the case at that point?
Yeah, I think that's always may always be true in certain individual cases, but the dimensions of the program and its rationale were certainly exposed to the Congress.
Mm-hmm. On the end of the 1960s, say late at the end, at the close of the Johnson administration, at the close of the Johnson administration, what was your reading of the political situation in Iran at that point? Was there less was there much less concerned about internal stability by this point? Less concerned about the Shah's overall position in the country?
Yes, I think there was a feeling that the Shah had come a long way from the period in the early 60s. The White Revolution was moving along. There really had been a systematic effort to bring the Western educated economists and other development specialists into the development program and planning implementation process in Iran. I think this was a moment when generally the opposition among the student community in the United States had diminished, so that there weren't the same kinds of political red flags that there had been earlier in the 60s. So I think, although I wouldn't describe the people in the outgoing Johnson administration as feeling that the job was done in Iran and that we could wash our hands of the situation in Iran. Not at all. I think there was a feeling, and I mentioned this last time, there was in the bureaucracy, there was certainly a feeling of the need to continue the annual review of the resource allocations and that kind of thing. And as I mentioned last time, there was a proposal sometime early in the Nixon administration to continue that review, and that's when it was cut off.
Let's move on to the Nixon period, I guess. With the arrival of the new administration in early 69, did that have any special impact on your position on the NSC staff?
Well, as it turned out, no. My job did continue, but I was the only member of the senior staff that did continue. Everybody else left, and therefore everybody dealing with other areas was new. But Kissinger brought in an almost completely new crew.
Did your duties largely continue in the same scope as before?
Yes, although some of the specifics changed, as I mentioned before. The review, the middle level group in the NSC structure, the sub-cabinet level group in the NSC system, was shifted from the State Department to the White House. Kissinger became the chairman. So while the purpose was the same, namely to develop and flesh out options and understand their consequences, these were now done in this group in the White House, and Kissinger felt strongly about the need for very thorough analytical papers on these issues. The demand on us increased markedly to all the same mental process. The written product increased many fold.
Had you known Kissinger in earlier years, or did you? That was the first time you encountered him?
Yeah.
Now, during the first months of the administration, was there any special shift in policy towards Iran, or did it sort of continue on the same basis under Johnson?
I think there was a visible shift. First of all, there was this sense that the Shah was one of the statesmen of the world. I can't remember when, but it would be pinpointed as the time when the Shah first visited Washington in the Nixon administration. I remember going up to the Iranian embassy and sitting with Kissinger in a conversation with the Shah. And there was a genuine sharing of strategic views of the world, and Kissinger was dealing with the Shah as one of the world's global, the world's statesmen, figures capable of thinking in global terms. And in that context, I think Kissinger's general opposition to involving the U.S. and telling other people how to run their own countries, to use his word, was brought out. And it's in this context that he said there won't be a review, the U.S. review of the allocation of resources inside Iran. The Shah will do that. So there was a sense that the Shah was a global figure, should be allowed to run his own country, should not be subjected to U.S. niggling about the way he managed his programs. But I think that that was a different posture, and it sounds as if I may be making more of that than any particular act would justify. I think, however, it's an extremely important shift, because of course later you have the on arms sales, the judgment that the U.S. won't tell the Shah what to buy, whatever the Shah wants to buy, he will buy. That turned loose some opposition in the Congress. It also led people, some people in Iran, to think more sharply about the, quote, squandering, unquote, of resources on the military build-up to, quote, satisfy the whims of the Shah and his generals, unquote. And as time went on, this initial attitude produced quite a different posture toward Iran, quite a different relationship between the U.S. and Iran.
Well, this visit by the Shah, was this during the Eisenhower funeral? Was that that visit here? Early 69, I think it was March or so. Do you recall?
I can't remember whether it was then or whether he paid a state visit.
It was one in September, a state visit. Well, whatever. But in any case, that was the first time you met the Shah at that meeting?
Probably, yes. Yeah.
Did you, what kind of impression?
Wait a minute, no. Yeah. No. I mentioned last time he came almost once a year in the later years of the Johnson administration, and I had met him. I'd met him during those visits.
So you were involved in the discussions that Tabitha people had with the Shah, or you sat in on the meetings that they had?
Yes, I don't. I can't cite dates now, but the answer is yes. There would inevitably be the moments when the president went off with the Dean Rusk and Rostow or whatever, but I would not be involved in any, certainly the general talk surrounding the Shah's visits.
What impression did you get of the Shah, say, in the late 60s, and maybe his early visit with Kissinger?
A very keen mind, quite capable of a of a very serious discussion with Kissinger on strategic issues, and I think a global sense. I don't think that it was unjustified to think of him as a figure with a world view. Some of that was overblown in terms of the actual resources that he represented. He was a figure of considerable stature, and also, as I say, at this point, there was a clear sense that the white revolution had put the Shah out in front of his opposition and had permitted him to position himself so that he could bring erstwhile critics behind him and give them a sense that they were involved in the modernization of Iran. At that moment, he successful.
So he seemed confident in himself. There are suggestions that he's, you know, he lacks confidence at certain points, but at that point,
I think that must have, when I look back over his whole regime, one might have picked those couple of years in there, 68, 69, as almost the high water mark. Although the appearance of that continued on into the early 70s, particularly with the kickoff of oil revenues and the boost that gave to development. So it may be, an Iran scholar might describe a span of 3 or 4 years there, which would be described as the high water mark.
Interesting. I read a story of the late 69, or I guess the summer of 69, Nixon gave his press conference at Guam, which came to be called as the Nixon Doctrine. to what degree was policy towards Iran shaping up along the lines of the Nixon Doctrine, the idea of letting regional powers maintain stability in their area? Was that the approach that Kissinger was taking?
I think the two are compatible. I don't know which is the chicken, which is the egg. I did not, although Kissinger was a consultant of the NSC staff back in the earlier 60s, I remember he had an office across the hall from where Comer and I sat. I didn't really know him then, and I became conscious of the at one point of the fact that he was no longer there, and I can't remember when I asked the question, but the question is, where's Kissinger, why isn't he around anymore? Well, at some point, either then or after he was the NSC advisor, I learned that one of the reasons for his bowing out as a consultant on that NSC staff was that he did not find himself in agreement with the general posture of the Kennedy administration, which we discussed before, to use aid, military and economic, as a means of playing an American role in the political, institutional development as well as the economic development of other countries. Kissinger basically, as I said before, didn't feel we should, quote, tell other people how to run their countries, but one can argue as to whether he was philosophically consistent in other circumstances later on. But that's not the point here. The point is that I think he came into office with some disposition of that kind. So, across the board in Iran, there was the posture we discussed of letting the Shah run his own show. If at the same time you were Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, looking at the fact that it was going to be increasingly difficult in the American body politic in the future to have another Vietnam, quote unquote, or to go to the aid of any other country under a communist threat or suffering some form of internal disintegration which seemed to invite communist involvement in a sensitive area, that the American body politic was not going to respond very favorably to that. Therefore, there was the Guam Doctrine or the Nixon Doctrine was designed to meet that problem by saying we weren't going to involve ourselves in the Persian Gulf as the British pulled back, for instance, but we were going to rely more heavily on strengthening our friends and allies do their own regional policing. So it was compatible with Kissinger's basic instincts, but it also was an important response to a very strongly and keenly felt political need to change the public's picture of what these relationships were, in order to build political support for the continuation of the relationship. The change picture was necessary to give people a sense of why these ongoing relationships were important and were not just the potential invitation to walk into another quagmire.
Well, that's very interesting. Well, I guess this first year also of the administration, Henry Kissinger also had the NSC prepare a report on the U.S. response to the British decision to pull out of the Persian Gulf over time. Did you have any role in the preparation of this?
No, when I spoke earlier, the heavy staff work, this is what I'm referring to. Yes, there was an elaborate NSC exercise which involved all three levels of the NSC, and it included everything from the question of arms sales to the Gulf countries on over to diplomatic representation. How would we have an embassy in each country, et cetera. So it was quite an elaborate exercise from beginning to end.
What, in terms of Iran, did the study have any special impact on policy towards the Shah, towards the arms sales?
I don't remember at this point exactly what it said, but I think you would go, if you went back there and back and looked at that study, you would certainly find the conceptual seeds of what later came to be called the Twin Pillars policy. You would find the notion that, and one of the big options dealt with was, should the United States replace the British, and in providing some sort of protectorate role in the Arab sheikhdoms. The answer was no, but that was option debate number one. What should be our posture? What of the British presence should the United States pick up? And that was a major posture decision. If it had not been for Vietnam, or if this had happened in the middle 60s, one could very easily have seen the United States moving in there and sort of becoming what the British had been, in some sort of protector role.
Were there any officials who advocated, in fact, that?
I don't recall any. I think there was just a feeling of about the difficulties. Mm-hmm. Playing that kind of role without the history in the background that the British had in the region.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think we wanted to saddle ourselves with that, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, there was a need there that, of course, was out of deep in the need.
In terms of arms sales, I mean, before the famous May 72 meeting with the Shah, where so-called the blank check was given, how were arms sales handled before in those 3 or 4 years? Did the Shah ask for more credits they were simply given, or was there some kind of informal review of his credit?
Oh, I think it was the regular bureaucratic discussion, but unlike the period of the 70s when there was a real review, that was. There must have been, there certainly must have been a sort of technical review about the appropriateness of one kind of piece of equipment rather than another. It was usable within the Shah's forces, and there must have been those kinds of reviews.
Now, one of the visits the Shah made, it was a September state visit, I'm not sure. He raised the question of bartering oil and agreed amounts per year for weapons, for U.S. weapons. We want to barter with oil for weapons, basically. Was there any discussions of that? Was that proposal discussed seriously in the next administration? Were there any?
As I recall, it was really an idea that was raised in the end of the Johnson administration, whether or not the Shah would put oil in underground reserves here in the United States. I can't remember when it first came out, but it was an active issue for several years, and probably active in the Johnson period and reactive it raised in the Nixon period.
Mm-hmm. Was there any interest at all in pursuing it, or was it sort of distraught quickly?
It's very difficult to carry out, and really was an effort made to sidetrack the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Last time you said at some point during the Nixon years, you were heavily involved in U.S. Arab-Israeli matters. When did that period of involvement start for you?
Well, really in the early 60s, yeah, except that the I became a member of the senior staff literally the 1st of June 1967. So my period as a member of the senior staff was really dominated, or at least a central continuing element after June 5th, 67, was the not just the war, but all the diplomatic aftermath of the war. And that really continued through the rest of my government career. Mm-hmm. Kissinger shuttles, Camp David, Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, from this early period of Nixon, 70, 71, did you have much? Did you participate very much in discussions over the oil price issues as they developed?
Not really. The whole energy business, oil price, energy availability business was handled in various ways in the White House by an economic group. It was a sort of a classic question looking at the NSC in this period, how were economic issues to be handled? And Kissinger gave himself the latitude to incorporate economic issues in consideration of policy, as I guess anybody would agree would make sense. But I think he was notorious for not being excessively interested in economic affairs. And so there was a perennial problem how to weave those issues into the NSC process. And when it came to the energy problem, there was an energy group set up elsewhere in the White House, which sort of had overlapping membership with various people, headed that effort as an effort separate from the NSC. And so oil price issues tended to be diverted into the economic community in the White House, not the NSC.
Like I said, it'll bring us to the May 1972 meetings between the Shah, Nixon, Kissinger, and Tehran. Did you attend? Were you in Tehran at that time?
At that time, and I attended some of the meetings. Obviously, the meetings where the blank check was given, the Kurdish decision was made, and so on. All of that was really done, not exactly tete-a-tete meetings, but meetings where Nixon and Kissinger were the only Americans present. Probably the Shah was the only Iranian president. I don't know who else might have been there.
How would you describe the impact of these May 72 meetings on the U.S. approach towards Iran in the following years?
A lot of people regard them as milestone events. I regard them more, as should be apparent from what I've been saying, as a capstone event. The decisions that let the Shah buy what the Shah wanted, or the decision not to have the review, all of that by this time was virtually 4 years behind, or three years behind us in any case, going on into the fourth year. So I see the blank check, so-called blank check talk, as simply a ratification of a posture that had long since crystallized. So if you ask what the impact was, I think the impact was substantial, but it's not the impact of those meetings in Tehran. It was the impact of a policy which were maybe articulated more directly, more clearly in the Tehran meetings and thereafter than had been the case before.
Let me turn this over before we